What is it going to cost you to build what you want? What is it going to cost you to prove that the business model works? And what is it going to cost you to reach cash flow or break even? So you form those opinions and then multiply however long you think it is by the 2 to 3 times, right? If you're not in alignment at the start, you now have massive capital risk. Through no fault of your own, through not necessarily anyone's fault, you may do all the right things and never get there. That's a tough position to be in. So I always say, do the gut check. Does this work?
You are listening to Fingerprints on Success, the podcast dedicated to highlighting unique imprints left by business leaders, mentors, and successful entrepreneurs. In this show, we'll be bringing on a diverse range of serial entrepreneurs, professionals, leaders, and coaches to uncover the secrets behind achieving success both professionally and personally. Guiding you on this podcast is none other than Bill Barrett, an award-winning corporate and business law attorney and CEO of the law firm Mandelbaum Barrett PC, where he and his team have provided a full array of legal services to both businesses and individuals throughout the country. Get ready and let's get to the show.
Hi, everybody. Good day. This is Bill Barrett. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Mandelbaum Barrett, and we are on Fingerprints on Success, our podcast where we explore the lives and journeys of successful entrepreneurs and business persons from around the country. And today I am thrilled to have Alex Sadusky on our program. Alex is a entrepreneur, but has a very interesting background. And I thought bringing Alex on the show today would be great because he's done a couple of things that personally I think entrepreneurs find very, very interesting, which is starting a life in what I'll call corporate America and being a consultant with, at the highest level with McKinsey and Company and other ventures. And then, you know, ultimately, starting a business, Dental Card Services Alliance, and then more recently, True Blue Dental Management. So really going full circle to be a complete entrepreneur. I also think it's important because when it comes to dental card services, Alex went into an area that's wildly competitive, where a lot of people stay away from businesses where, you know, there's huge corporations and tremendous competition to have hard barriers to entry into a market. But yet he not only chose that, but turned it into a huge success. Alex, without further ado, just wanted to let everyone know why I thought it was terrific to have you on the show today. Why don't you, for people who aren't familiar with you personally, give us a little bit of a background on you and your story and how you got into these businesses and, you know, tell us a little bit about you.
No, Bill, first and foremost, thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. It's always great to connect. And, you know, it certainly has been a journey. And, you know, kind of if you had looked back 30 years ago, 25 years ago for me and said, you're going to be at this point, just a little bit over 50 or just turned 50, I'd be surprised to say the least, right? You know, I grew up in a very very risk averse family. And my dad grew up in a small town north of Allentown, Pennsylvania. His dad was a butcher or a coal miner originally, and then a butcher and a grocer. And, you know, stability of income was an important component of their life, and how to provide for your family year in, year out had a lot of focus. So, you know, I grew up in a family where, my dad, fortunate enough, he had a chance to go to a great college in Cornell. Actually played football and had a couple offers to go pro, but, you know, he wanted a stable job. And he was also an engineer, so he decided to become an airborne ranger. Went in the Army for about 22 years, and then subsequent that, partly I think for stability, and the other part his very strong service upbringing. He then spent 17 additional years working for the CIA, of which, you know, I was probably privy to the last two. But the reason I share that is, you know, I grew up in a very modest home. We didn't have a lot. Our family vacations, if we were going to go to the beach, we would find one that was near a military base. Because you could stay on the base, right? And I think the rooms might have for a family been $20. And, you know, the furniture was made in the prisons, very well made. And then when it was time to go to the beach, we'd hop in the family sedan, all five of us and drive to one of the fancy areas with hotels and kind of use the beach there and then, you know, sneak in to get food and beverage and things of that nature at the hotel. You know, when we travel, my mom was German. When we travel once a year to go see family in Europe, in Germany, we'd fly the military planes, which for those of you who aren't familiar with this, this means you get in your car in Fairfax, Virginia, and you drive about an hour and a half. I forget how long it was growing up. Felt like 5 hours to Dover Air Force Base. And you would sit in the terminal. And the reason you would sit there is you didn't have a reservation. You were on a list that basically the way it worked is if they didn't have any munitions and things like that on the plane that were incredibly hazardous, they would let people board and rank a priority and rank. And so some days you might be able to get on the plane that day, or some days it might take a couple days. But the neat thing about it was like $10 to fly to Germany. It was $12.50 if you wanted the meal, and it was the greatest meal ever. You know, the upside was every seat was built for a soldier with a giant pack, which was amazing. You know, the downside is sometimes you'd have to climb what felt like a chicken ladder out of the cargo bay into your seat. And it was a bit noisy, right? But I digress. So the reason I tell that story is, you know, I think people's career choices and where they end up is often initially a product of the environment they grow up in, right? So I grew up in an environment of engineers, no entrepreneurs anywhere, really no one in the business world, military, and things of that nature. And there was a premium on stability. And so I kind of made an initial choice. Well, I want to get into the finance. And I went down this route that was different than someone who may have had a different background, right? I was fortunate enough to get into investment banking coming out of undergraduate school and was exposed to a lot of things over the years. I would say jack of all trades, master of none was probably the best description of my first 10 years. You know, and during that time, I had a lot of great mentors. I will say at that time, though, work for me was work. It wasn't a passion. It wasn't something that, you know, I got up every day and just felt great at the end of the day. And that kind of experience is where I would say meandered. Certainly wasn't a straight uphill line or downhill line, but it's been up and down over the years. And, you know, about 13 years ago, I got lucky and finally said, you know what, I'm gonna start my own businesses. And, you know, fortunately enough, I got lucky on one, and that kind of started the journey to here today.
Well, that's great. And I relate, by the way, to what you're saying. You know, started my career in the early days at a worldwide law firm in New York City, and learned a lot, had a lot of great teachers, but definitely not, you know, not an enjoyable life, not something that, you know, that I would have personally wanted to do for decades. So I can completely relate to that. So what are, you know, talking about the businesses you're in? You know, what are, give people a little bit of background on the two companies currently that you're are running, and you know, maybe some of the things that you find you know, that are material about those companies, like what service it's delivering, and maybe some of the misconceptions about those two companies, and then we'll dive into some other questions.
No, I'd be happy to do that. I think what's ironic about the first, and I'll start with Dental Card Services. And actually, the best things I've done from an investment standpoint have always had a little bit of a similar example. A lot of dumb luck and a couple of failure in attempts that led to an opportunity, right? So Dental Card Services was not formed because I decided I wanted to get into credit card processing for dentists in North America. The actual origins of what led me into dentistry at that time was I was looking to purchase a business in the pay card industry, which some folks might remember, but over about, you know, 15, 20 years ago, that was a very fast growing segment. You know, there's millions of Americans who were underbanked or unbanked. And the financial ecosystem in this country was set up in a way where they were extremely disadvantaged, right? You know, they would have to go to a check cashing store to cash their check because they didn't have a bank account. So by the time you included all the fees and everything they dealt with, Yeah, they were severely disadvantaged for all the hard work, and their net pay was, you know, a fraction of what they should have taken home if they had had more comparable access to the financial services sector. At that time, I went to buy that business. Unfortunately, the deal fell through, and my sponsor passed at the last second. And that was okay. But what was interesting is during that time, I came across this thing called interchange. Had no idea what it meant, but everyone kept telling me, oh, this is the secret way everyone makes a ton of money. I was like, that sounds very interesting. And started to peel back the onion on it and noticed that, well, it was a highly deregulated industry and there was a lot of noise and confusion in it. And that was something to me that sounded somewhat interesting. Ian can say, well, why would that be interesting? Because I've always found that specialization and niche focus from my prior experiences could create exceptional opportunities. You know, the best example was way back when I used to work for a company called Columbia Capital Corporation. It was an old school merchant bank that focused in the telecom industry. If you watch the news today, you probably might see a Senator Mark Warner, Democratic senator from Virginia. He was one of the founders, right? There's five of them, but they knew telecom better than anybody in the country. And they did banking, they did merchant service, investing, venture capital, you name it. But that specialization enabled them to achieve incredible returns. I actually think there's a Harvard case study that got written right after I left there. I think over a 10-year period, their IRR and their own money, and I think the amount they invested was well into about $150 million, was 194%, right? So specialization has mattered, right? Like an understanding of niche. So I get into this space and I'm looking at this interchange. I'm going, well, how it works is incredibly complicated. There's a lot of noise. It seems very unregulated as far as what is the impact is even on you, Bill, as a business owner, right? What is the impact of how you're charged for these services? And do you even understand? Sure. And so I looked at that and said, wow, this would be a really neat business to be into. But you already alluded to it in the opening. Why would you go into a business where every bank's in it, every financial services firm's in it, and there's probably 20,000 providers doing it, right? Not a lot of real true differentiation. Well, I looked at it and said, well, I have an angle. At this time, most of my friends from my earlier days in banking, were in private equity and they owned restaurant chains. Well, restaurants do a lot of transactions. And I said, oh, this is going to be easy. I'm going to go and open up a platform that serves credit card processing to restaurants. And, you know, created a program, got the best pricing, laid it all out. Life was going to be great. And it was taken forever to convince anybody to do anything. As part of that process, we decided, well, what was the best way to kind of go and benchmark how to really do this the right way? We said, oh, this is be interesting. Why don't we go talk to dentists? And you got to kind of have to understand why that at that time sounded like a great idea, right? We were going to use dentists as the case study while why to get into other sectors. And the thought process was, if you really understood the true cost of interchange, not what you are processing, not what you pay as a business owner, because that may have nothing to do with it. It came down to a couple of things, right? One is, what's the inherent business risk, right? If a business is not sound, it carries more risk. Because fundamentally, if you go out of business, then the person who stood behind your merchant account actually has to make good on all those charges or all those payments you took for services you hadn't fully rendered. Mm. Or for services that you rendered that weren't up to satisfaction and they were successful chargeback, right? So there's this theoretical risk there. It's not theoretical, it's real in some sectors. So then we looked at dentistry and said, most dental practices are pretty darn sound, right? If you look at the default rates in dentistry, especially if you couple it with owning the real estate, it's like non-existent for the most part, right?
Yeah, it's like one of the lowest risks for a lender in the country.
Yeah, so beautiful business, right? Then you go and say, well, everybody who takes credit cards, and I say everybody, the vast majority, unless you're a large corporation, there's a personal guarantee associated with that, which means if the business doesn't pay, and I know as you as a top legal professional can understand this more than anybody, like there's someone still standing behind it, right? And that's the personal guarantee. Well, you look at it, it's a sound business, great owners, dentists tend to be pretty well off. Very low risk. That makes a lot of sense, right? And this is the thinking going back to 08, right? Third is you look at the riskiness of a transaction, right? Well, am I doing it over the phone? Am I buying something online? Am I buying a weight loss drug because I saw a nice infomercial on it? No, this is someone in person with their credit card. You know me, I know you. The risk of the transaction is very low, right? And the fourth is, you know, what are the services being provided? Are you billing in advance? Are you billing and collecting payment after the service? And is there a high risk of a change in perspective on what was delivered, right? So you go through all that noise and you say, man, Dennis should be paying less than everybody in the world for this great service. And we went and researched it and we did a survey of 10 practices and it was the absolute opposite of everything I just said, right? So we had this hypothesis, and I'll get to my hypothesis level thinking later, but we had this hypothesis, we were 100% wrong. All but I think one of the dental practices was paying probably 50 to 75% more than they should be. They were paying vastly more, when I say should be, meaning a fair market transaction cost. They're paying a lot more on a percentage markup basis than higher risk businesses with lower fidelity, lower, and we couldn't figure out why, right? So then we started to peel back and we determined it was for a confluence of a couple factors, right? One, medical professionals are very trusting. And I know I'm going to make some generalizations, right? But they have high level of integrity, high level of ethics. It's embodied in their education. It's embodied in their service mentality of why they went into profession to help people. And that's one side of it. The second side of it is they genuinely tend to be a little bit more removed from the business day to day because they're embedded in the clinical function. Not always, nor do they need to be, but so they had less exposure. And the part of the trusting thing is they tended to have a lot of confidence in the internal ecosystems that they were operating in, right? Well, we found out, wow, this makes no sense, right? This is what's happening. We said, well, how do we, maybe we should do something in dentistry. And that's literally why we got into dental card, right? Now, how we got lucky, our belief was, and this is kind of like you said, you know, we confronted reality up front, right? Were we going to spend more than the two largest banks who lend more money to every dentist in the country to market their merchant services? No, we would never do that, right? Second, are we going to be able to raise a bunch of money to enter a sector or a segment where 20,000 providers or more are in every day to build out a national sales force and go after it? Probably not, right? That wouldn't be the best idea. Well, how could we be different? Well, what we decided to do at that time, and it worked, right? I can say in hindsight, it worked. It was a risk. Was we were going to be the lowest cost provider, period. We were going to have no outbound salespeople, meaning no overhead, right? So we never wanted to have to charge more just to feed the engine, right? So we went with the lowest cost. Second is I mentioned earlier that there was a lot of confusion on what the true costs are and what you pay. We said, forget that. We're going to treat everybody the same. So everyone's going to get access to the same type of pricing plan the large corporations get. And we're going to do it up front. So from day one, you never had to show me how bad or us how bad you're getting taken care of for us to price quote you. It was always, here it is. And third, and I learned this a long time ago when I was at McKinsey, it was on the people side, and I'll get to it later, but it was really around, if I'm not providing you value, Bill, then I don't want you to do business with me. And keeping you stuck doing business with me when I'm not providing you value is both a disservice to you and a disservice to my brand. So we always believed upfront that there's no early termination penalty. So in an industry that you sign that paper, you are, for the vast majority of the providers, locked under a 36-month agreement, which actually gives them the right to change their pricing whenever they want with 30 days notice. And if you continue to process...
I've experienced that. experienced that personally.
Yeah. So we did those things. And what did that enable us? That enabled us to tell everybody with confidence, if you don't like us, you can leave. If we're not giving you the value, you can leave. And so slowly over time, we were able to outperform and out-execute the larger, more established, and now let's be clear, it comes back to what your definition of outperform is, but we were able to outperform the competition. And it enabled us to grow a business that today, I think it's one of the leading providers in North America. We're on our third extension as the exclusive provider under the AGD, Academy of General Dentistry Benefits Program. We've worked with a lot of the leading dental-centric CPA firms. And, you know, here's three stats I'll tell you, which really, I think, brings it home. And then I'll pause for a second. One, 99% of every customer contacts us. In an industry where you typically are calling 99% of your prospects to become a customer. Two, we convert over 50% of every inbound phone call into a customer in an industry that typically averages about 1.5 to 2%. And three, our average customer life is, you know, almost 10 years plus in an industry that's usually a couple of years, right? Those results are a result of having the right model and service mentality up front. It took a long time to become a very good business because we had to grow organically to stay true to our mission, which is really to help small business, because that's what we were going after, and to do it the right way, right? Could have gotten there a lot faster doing it other ways, but that one served us well.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's interesting. You know, when you talk to a lot of entrepreneurs, I can even reflect on my own career in terms of entering different markets as an attorney. A lot of times what you really hear after you hear someone's story is, in some respects, it happens on accident sometimes, right? You know, you were going to target the hospitality industry and then all of a sudden, you know, you start peeling the layers of the onion back and you end up in a totally different segment, which becomes wildly successful, and which is incredible. So I want to like briefly touch on the other company that you've started from scratch and founded and are the CEO of, TrueBlue Dental Management, just so that the listeners have a flavor for, you know, not only have you already over the last, I guess now 17 years, right, with Dental Card, you've got that business, it's been built, it's significant. The entrepreneur in you has ventured into yet another segment. I'd like to give the listener a little flavor for that business. And then really, then I want to spend the rest of our time diving into you and talking more about some of your philosophies. But I want the listener to kind of have an understanding of, you know, that most people might be satisfied with one very successful entrepreneurial enterprise, but you saw a need and decided to start a second one. Tell us a little bit about it.
No, I'd love to do that. To be fair, I can't take credit for really jumping into this. It took a fair amount of influence and outreach from some very good friends and long-term colleagues. Many, many years ago, I also was the vice president of office, the CEO of Dentsply by Sirona, which is at that time, the world's largest publicly traded dental equipment and consumable company. If you go back several years prior to that, when I worked at the legacy Sirona Dental Systems, which ultimately merged, there were two public companies with Dentsply, I had the privilege of running certain things in the U.S. One was all the dental, back then, the group practices. The second was the technology CAD/CAM selling programs, as well as some special initiatives. During that time, I had the pleasure of meeting a company I had never heard of, which was Fortune Management. And two of their principals at that time, Bernie Stoltz and Jennifer Chevalier. And what blew me away about Fortune was a couple things. So as you know, my background, I served with McKinsey & Company as a consultant. Many, many years ago, post-retiring from Dentsply Sirona, I also served as senior external advisor to them in pharma and med tech globally. That's a story for maybe another day if time permits. But when I saw Fortune and I saw the caliber of their people, the integrity, the ethics, the uniqueness of their clients, you know, they served at that time, I think it was over 1,000 dental practices, and they were just different. And they were exceptional. I had the utmost respect for them. And we had a discussion going back on, I think, almost 10 years ago about, you know, at some point we need to take a stand for private practice dentistry. We need to help the independents. And so you kind of fast forward several years ago, I want to say 5 or 6 years ago. So probably that Fortune conversation was even farther back. And reached out and said, look, we have a group of doctors who are really looking for something to change the game and leveling the playing field for the independents against the, you know, the large corporate DSOs. You know, would you like to do this with them and with the group that's being formed? And the why was strong enough for me to say, absolutely, I would do it. But it was the why coupled with the who, right? Dental card services, that was a grind. It took a long time, right? And as you can probably tell, I got a little bit less hair these days and a little more
gray. A lot more than me. Yeah. So,
well, we'll see. I'm looking this way. You won't ever see the backside. But the idea being like, look, it is not easy to go into a space and create something disruptive, right? And I can tell you, dental card was disruptive. The amount of money we saved practices over the last decade plus has been massive. And I think we fundamentally are changing how dentists are treated in that category. What we are doing at True Blue is even bigger and a higher responsibility. And to do that by yourself, without great partners, without great investors, without great resources, would be even more challenging than it is, right? And so the idea that, hey, we could take a stand for the independent dentist, kind of going back to my upbringing, you know, that was important from a small business standpoint. I can do it with great people and great partners. All right, I'm in. So what we did is we created a platform. It's called True Blue Dental Management, Inc. Now you can kind of say, well, why'd you do an Inc. versus an LLC? For me, the Inc. makes all the sense in the world because we're trying to create something not to provide an immediate return to investors and see how much money we can make in the short term, but we're trying to create a platform that allow us to continue to invest and build out additional solutions that solve these challenges or address these opportunities to independent dentists. And it takes years, right? So as you know, with an LLC, you got to make the distributions. Well, with the C-Corp, you can invest and you don't have the tax hit to continue to build those solutions. So we operated. Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I mean to interrupt you, but tell the listener a little, you know, in terms of, you know, what is the company doing to help doctors be able to compete?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. So what we did real quick. So we got all these great clinicians in the room, some of the initial investors, and we literally did a whiteboard. And I forget the hotel. It was at a resort in California. All the major challenges independent dentists are faced with. And then we bucketed them into categories of, can we solve it relatively quickly? How big of an impact does it have short term? And how important is it strategically long term to address, right? So as a result of that, we started launching independent operating companies, separate LLCs, to address some of these challenges. So one of the platform companies we created was True Blue Plan for Health. You might know of it in the market as a dental membership plan. Some people might call it a wellness plan. We call ours a wellness plan, but it addressed a couple problems, right? One, over 50%+ of Americans do not have dental insurance. And I use that word somewhat as an oxymoron because let's face it, it's a benefit, right? That benefit amount probably hasn't changed. The $1,000 deductible, whatever it is these days, probably hasn't changed materially in the last 30 years, right? But you have a large segment of the population that doesn't go and to the dentist frequently, and you have a large segment of the population that doesn't have insurance. Well, if you look at the large DSOs, they've already figured out ways and going back to how do we cater to, how do we create solutions that attract and retain those patients, right? So we created a platform to do that. Now, where ours is slightly different than some is I view it more as a consulting service with a software facilitator, right? I personally don't think software at a base level adds value unless it addresses some key inputs in this area, right? First is doing more of something unless you know you have the right fee schedules is probably a little bit like doing chiropractic or medical without having a diagnosis, right? So one of the first things we do is we go through the fee schedules, right? Are your fee schedules where they need to be, right? In the market. Second is your practice and clinical philosophy, right? One of the advantages of not having a third party involved between the doctor and the patient is you can actually deliver the optimal patient care based on the patient need, not based on the insurance requirements or plans, right? So you understand the clinical philosophy and the patient need. I'm a perfect example. I don't have dental insurance. And for me, getting my going to hygiene three times a year is the right example. If I was on dental insurance, most people say, well, you can only go twice. Well, no, that just means the benefit's only twice. Well, for me, no, absolutely three is the right answer. So, right. So you go through the practice philosophy, the patient demographics, the practice service areas, and you create oral wellness programs that are optimized for that business owner and their clinical team. The software and the solution just makes it easy to manage and administrate that and market it to the patients. And obviously to do so in a compliant way, right? Which is huge, right? So members on our program, and obviously thanks to Mandelbaum Barrett's legal team, get access to that know-how.
We gladly accept the shameless plug, Alex. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a shameless plug. No, but it matters. And the reason it matters is I had a doctor come up to me 2 weeks ago at Dental Supply Serono World going, I need to talk to you. We're doing it this way. And I'm not a lawyer and I'll never pretend one. And I said, I would suggest you seek counsel because I think you might have exposure. And they said, yeah, well, I operate in this state. Can you help me? And I said, we cannot because in our read, it's not compliant in that state. And they were moved, right? Like literally most people would have just said, yeah, I'd be happy to take your money. I don't have any liability whatsoever, right? But they walked away knowing that not everybody is looking out for their best interests. Right. And that's a little bit of a common theme. Right. So the solution's fantastic. Now, I will tell you, this is where I get a little bit, not on the high horse, but this is when if you get me, see me passionate about preservation of private practice industry, I will tell you this, you know, the average dental practice, if you go out there, takes insurance. Right. And the vast majority of them who raise their hand every year and say, man, this was a great year. My insurance company called me up and said, I'm going to pay you more because I think you're doing a great job. Typically doesn't happen. At the same time, you have certain states, right? Whether it be Rhode Island, where you have a massive consolidation and very low reimbursements for oral surgeons now, where it's, I think you probably have less oral surgeons, half of the oral surgeons today than you did a decade ago. Folks who go to school can't even go there because the reimbursements are so great, right? So you got this generational issue in the transfer of practices. You have others where the payer consolidation has been so aggressive that you know, they wake up and say, we're going to reduce your fees by X, right? So you have this dynamic. And the reason I was describing that is diversifying your customer base is not a bad thing, right? And typically when you ask folks, well, how many customers you have, they think of, well, I have X number of patients. Well, you have that many consumers. That's not necessarily the customer, right? And I make a slight distinction because the customer is the one, in my mind, in this example, who's writing the check, who's paying the bill, right? So if 80 or 90% of your revenue is dictated by one provider, you can find yourself with an undue amount of risk, right? And it becomes very difficult to manage that risk in certain environments, like inflation, right? So the thing for me for Plan for Health is whether you use TrueBlue Plan for Health or someone else's platform, I strongly recommend that, you know, from an independent dentist standpoint, you need to explore that area. Because it's good for you long term. There's also financial benefits. I mean, the three simple things why you want one, other than diversification, these other things that I call long term strategic choices. Patients come to recall at a higher rate. Patients accept the value added additional clinical dentistry you recommend at a higher rate, and they have a higher referral rate. Right now, is that traditionally unique to dentistry? No, we've seen that in a lot of other membership loyalty-based programs. That's why they exist in a lot of industries, right? So that's what Plan for Health is doing. That's one of our platforms. One of the ones that I like to talk about because it's kind of like this thing that if I could just get everybody to try it for 1 month, the average dental practice would recapture $40,000 a year in profit. But it's a little bit of it takes folks time to really believe you and hear about it from their peers is TrueBlue Direct. And this is an amazing platform. And I'll kind of put it into two buckets. We have this BRACE program. An independent practice today could sign up for TrueBlue Direct, create an account, and bill, if they signed up today on November 1st, I'm going to charge them $99, right? For the month of November. And keeping with my earlier lessons in dental card, we've made it easy, right? If you don't like us between now and the end of October, you click a little cancel button in our software and you never charge. So you get this almost no look chance. And if you want to optimize your free $99 a month. You can sign up on the second of every month. Now, why is that important to me? Because this is about transparency and trust long-term. And our view is we want to provide the optimal amount of value. We want to do a great job with our partners who are supporting us in creating these tools for you, the independent dentist, to access the best in dentistry at an exceptional value. So that $99 fee, and I know I hit the economics first, I just like to get the sales stuff out of the way, gives you access to vendor programs that are the best in class in the country. So now an independent dentist, some people call TrueBlue Direct a group purchasing organization. I try to shy away from that language, but it's probably the best comparison. Gets unique programs that give you unparalleled value on some of the items you use in dentistry, such as clear aligners, implants, and endo. Or it gives you access to exceptional law firms, financial services, software systems, solutions. People who stand for independent dentistry, people who've stood up and said, you know what, for your member, for your membership of technology-oriented dental practices, we're going to do something distinctive. And today we have over 15, I think it's almost 17 partners. If folks go to TrueBlue Direct, and you know, we made it a little bit difficult, there's no E in True or Blue, you'll see some of those firms, and they are the best in dentistry. And we're proud to have them. You may ask, well, why those firms? Right? Why did you partner with those firms? And the answer for me is, you know, we're trying to create a platform that enables independent dentistry to survive and thrive for generations. Right. And kind of going back to my background, we talked about earlier about how experience can impact your view. I know unequivocally that a technology-oriented dental practice with a great culture, clinician, team, coach, representative, will outperform any other type of practice in the country. I know that because I did the study over a decade ago. There is no overcompensating for an independent owned business.
Enjoying the show so far? We've received fantastic feedback since we started, and we love your questions. Entrepreneurs face unique challenges, and as a corporate attorney and CEO, Bill understands that. Whether it's your first location, industry regulations, succession plans, or exit strategies for your business, the journey is rarely a smooth one. Mandelbaum Barrett PC offers listeners of this podcast a 20-minute consultation with their award-winning team. From mergers and acquisitions to litigation, they help entrepreneurs navigate new opportunities, get invaluable insights, and support to not just survive, but thrive. Click the link in the episode description or visit mblawfirm.com for details. Once again, it's mblawfirm.com. Now, back to our show.
It's just the consumer, the teams, they outperform on every level. Now, there is a DSO out there that did an exceptional job, and I'd put them in the second bucket, but it was an amazing culture and technology oriented, and they're kind of the tier two, but there's a tier three and a tier four by far, right? So indirect.
Sure. And by the way, for our listeners, who many of whom will not be involved in the dental industry at all, you know, a DSO in essence is the opposite of what you're talking about. TrueBlue, as you're describing it, is this entity that you've created to fight for the preservation of private practice dentistry and give doctors the opportunity to compete. And DSOs, for the listener, are in essence the practice of corporate dentistry. This would be the consolidation of independent practices where they're no longer independent. You know, just for the listeners, so that they have a kind of like a flavor for what that is. So what I'm hearing from you really is, you know, there's a lot of passion here, and throughout the stories that you've been telling us about these two entities, a number of guiding principles have been kind of like baked into that conversation. And you talked about transparency, you know, and you talked about trying to provide something that they can't get anywhere else. I'd like to maybe just try to shift this conversation a little bit more about you as the entrepreneur. And maybe, you know, if you had to list out, you know, two or three guiding principles that you when you reflect upon your success have been a huge part of that. What would some of them be? And on the flip side, if you had to talk to, you know, one of our listeners right now, one of our entrepreneurs, and say, you know, upon reflecting on this, on your career, having seen your, having been into the business career from the institutional side, as well as the entrepreneurial side, what are a couple of pitfalls or things that, you know, that the almost 50-year-old Alex would tell the 35 or 40-year-old Alex to watch out for? So I'd love to hear a couple guiding principles and then maybe kind of the bear traps to watch out for.
No, that'd be great, Bill. And look, it is, you know, I have failed by a factor of probably 1,000x times more than I've been successful at anything, right? One of the freedoms I was given in life early on in my career was thanks to some great mentors. And, you know, one of my favorites was working at McKinsey. And it was this whole hypothesis driven, right? So it was always like, hey, form an opinion, test it. And the minute you figure out, you know, what do you have to believe for this to be true? Or what do you have to believe for this not to be true? The minute you figure it out, it's not true, move on. It's okay not being right, but have an opinion so you know which direction you're going to go, right? And I think too often that analysis of paralysis, this idea that, you know, I had this opinion, I got to hold true to it, gets in the way of evolving and quickly and increases the time it takes for you to figure out what is the core solution, what is the way you need to do this, what is the right way to scale this, right? So one is, I think it's okay to fail, and it's okay to be wrong. Right. And I used to, you know, have this phrase, and I won't say it today, environment, but like, stop doing what's not working as quickly as you know it's not working. And, you know, directionally correct is better than precisely wrong every day of the week in the startup world. Right now, I'm also operating in the mindset of what I call small ball, right? Small ball in my mind is not when you're making multi-million-dollar bets on something, right? And, you know, I have a natural desire, probably bias to smaller investment type opportunities, because it was more about, I never wanted to be reliant on someone deciding ultimately 3 years from now whether or not they were going to fully fund my endeavor, right? So from an entrepreneur standpoint, I look at it and I say, you know, first of all, you know, do you have alignment, right? And alignment is a tough one, right? Because alignment in my mind is around a couple different things, right? You have alignment on a funding standpoint, right? You know, and there's a recent bankruptcy that's out there now, and there's a lot of large bankruptcies coming. And you know, my first question is, are you fully funded, right? You know, what is it going to cost you to build what you want? What is it going to cost you to prove that the business model works? And what is it going to cost you to reach cash flow or break even, right? So you form those opinions, and then multiply however long you think it is by 2 to 3 times, right? If you're not in alignment at the start, you now have massive capital risk, right? Through no fault of your own, not necessarily anyone's fault, you may do all the right things and never get there. That's a tough position to be in, right? So I always say, you know, do the gut check. Does this work? Right?
Yeah. And by the way, I once had a client. I remember we had a conversation, and he said, "It's hard to be a capitalist without capital." So, you know, when you talked about knowing you're aligned and that you've got your funding and that you're playing small ball, which I translate into being conservative and cautious. But not to put words into your mouth, but
no, that's a fair analogy. Well, look, you're going to laugh. I'm not going to tell you which business because I've had a couple exits. But my best return ever was a $500 investment. My second best return ever was a $500 investment. Right? Now, those had different dynamics, right? But where I was going with that is, you know, I've got some friends out there who have some of the most amazing things. And you look at it and go, those are billion-dollar things. They work. I get it. It's going to work. But they're going to have to raise $30 to $40 million of capital to have a fully funded deal. If they don't execute that right along the way, or they scale too early, they're going to be the founder and their initial partners, the founder of something that was ultimately a massive success, in the best case for someone else, and the worst case, they won't see it to fruition, right? So I have a lot of concern over that. Some of that we can delve into, I think, is driven by the way the carried interest phenomenon works, right? There's a lot of talk. You see it on unicorns, this and that. Well, I'm going to tell you, it's a heck of a lot easier to figure out how to make $5,000 a month than $50,000, than $500,000, than a million. And I think too often we try to scale and hit that home run before we figured out how to get singles, how to load the bases, how to do a sacrifice bunt, bring a score in, right? Like we don't build the building blocks.
It's the real estate, our firm has a huge real estate department, a lot of very entrepreneurial developers and builders. And a common story you hear among many of them is, you know, when you say, where did you start out? How did you get into involved in the development business? And often it's, I bought a lot and subdivided it into two and I built two houses. Right. And, or I bought a two family house and I renovated it and I rented it out. And then I refinanced it and I bought a four family house. And, you know, very few of, and now we literally have some of the largest developers, you know, in some cases, some larger developers in the United States as clients. And I can't tell you any of them who said, yeah, I started out with this $50 million project. Right. It often starts out with, you know, an idea, a concept, and, you know, a comfort level on risk allocation. How much risk are you willing to take? What's prudent? Because if you get rolled up on deal one, there's probably not going to be a deal two. But if you hit a few singles, now all of a sudden people around you even say, oh, you know, next time you're going to do a deal, I'd love to hear about it. But all you've done is really hit some singles. But you know what? If your batting average is high hitting singles, you could still make it to the Hall of Fame. So,
yeah, which is crazy, right? I mean, you can fail 2/3 of the time and you're in Coopertown, right? It's an amazing thing, but like I think the other advantage of small ball initially early on is the value in the strikeouts are massive, and as long as you're not getting knocked out and can never play the game again, it's that learning is incredible, right? So like you think of your larger clients who grew organically, they probably learned a ton along the way, right? And it wasn't as painful as a couple $100 million knockouts, right? It's just, it's tough, right? So I think the capital things is a real issue. And I back in my VC days, I can't tell you the number of plans. I mean, probably saw 1,000 in 2 years when I worked for Memphis Angels. The amount of plans that didn't have those elements in alignment was tough, right? The second part was to me, it's the math of the business. And I'm going to, I'll probably unfairly kind of generalize it, right? But it's like, what does it cost to acquire a customer? What value do you get annually for that customer? And what's the lifetime value of that customer, right? Like those elements, to me, in a lot of businesses, I look at the recent bankruptcy of Smile Direct, right? And I'm not going to proclaim to be an expert in the direct consumer. But there's a couple things that, just strike me as question, right? Did they fail because they raised $1.3 billion in cash in their IPO? I mean, could you assume that probably was a sufficient amount of capital? Yeah.
Yeah. I'd right. Say so.
I mean, were they backed by some of the smartest people in the most successful venture and PE firms? Absolutely. Right. What I'd love to see, and I don't think I've ever seen it, is, what did it really cost them to acquire a customer? I saw the news and I could see, hey, they're selling clear aligners at, X percent less. I don't know, it was 50 or 60%. But, were they selling aligners for less than it costs to acquire that customer when you overlaid the marketing investment? Were they, what was the different question, right? I think, having them in the market may have actually helped drive clear aligners because they spent a lot of money on marketing and that may have
They drove consumer acceptance basically through their marketing for the whole industry.
Yeah, which wasn't a bad thing, right? It reminded me of my favorite dentist. I go, do you do any marketing? He goes, no, I don't do any. I got the best website and best, that is marketing. But so every time my competitor runs ads, my phone lights up because they're running commercials and everyone goes online. They hear the commercial and they go, best dentist here, and they find me, right? So there may have been some floating, rising tide floats all boats there. But, you know, you look at it and it's a question, you know, not getting into the dental weeds, but, you know, my favorite thing about this, when I look at clear aligners, because, you know, you go and get clear aligners, if they go great, maybe you don't get a second set from Smile Direct, right? However, what business in the country doesn't have to pay for the patient in the chair who they sell clear aligners to? It's like a dentist, right? The dentist is already paid to acquire that customer. They're already in there getting, whether it's hygiene or another procedure. The clear aligner is an upsell, right? So beyond the clinical debate that folks have, because I don't want to weigh into that, is like there was a natural owner of that process, and it was the people who were always doing the process, right? So I struggle to say, you know, was that ever going to have a lot of long-term merit? I'm not sure it was. I mean, obviously, it migrated from a retail environment in 150 locations. But I think that's the other element is, you know, the basics. I think the third is, and this is kind of back to, you said, what are your looking at True Blue, at DentalCar, your philosophies. I've always loved, I've never been a salesperson in my life, never been a field or trained. I always love when I offer something that I know I charge $1 and my customer makes 10x. You know, I got that made up number from my time at McKinsey because, you know, as you may know, they charge an incredible amount for their services. And I one day heard my billing rate as a young professional. And I was like, how do we get away with that? And the partner looked at me and said, because you're going to deliver 10x value. And by the way, they were right. We actually delivered 20x value. Now, was it me? No, it was the great resources and support and processes I had behind me and the clients we went to serve, right? So I love playing a game where I know at the end of the day, I'm going to provide superior value. Then the question is, can I play that game long enough to drive market awareness and to get that organic engine coming in? Because if you can do that and you can keep your costs low, I think it's a big win.
Yeah, I think it's a great philosophy on the delivering of value and trying to, in essence, like almost like quantify it, you know, that if someone's going to spend $1 with you, that you want to deliver back $10 in essence in value. And I think that, you know, whether you're a service provider, a professional, a product provider, whatever it is, that, you know, at the end of the day, if people get the return, it's a good investment. And maybe words to live by for all businesses is to focus on what kind of return did I get to give to my customer.
Yeah. And so, I think you nailed it, Bill. And I think the, you know, the other side is, you know, said you originally, one of your earlier comments, you said, hey, what were some of the lessons learned or pitfalls? I mean, and this is not a plug for Mandelbaum. You know, I love you guys, right? The smartest thing I ever did on my first startup is I had great counsel. The dumbest thing I ever did was to not have counsel. And I can correlate the great stuff with that and the bad stuff with the other one. Now, here's how I view that. Great counsel is an investment. You're doing it up front, you're doing it strategically, and it pays dividends for a variety of reasons, and we can delve into that. Dumb investment or dumb counsel, meaning I didn't do it, and then I get them later, it's an expense because now I'm having to clean up something that wasn't done right or didn't afford me the protection or wasn't structured correctly, right? And it's just, if you don't have that relationship with your, you got to have one, right? And if you don't have a great relationship, find one because it is invaluable both to you professionally, personally, to your corporation, to your long-term success, right? There is no, I mean, you just can't kick this can down the road. And ultimately, it serves you well. You look more professional.
Well, I think, you know, you're emphasizing a point that we often tell entrepreneurs, and not just about us, not just about legal services, but, you know, when I have an entrepreneur as a client, I'll often say, you know, look at the team of professionals around you like you would your own board of directors. You know, you should have a great attorney. That's of course, but you should have a great accountant. You should have a great financial advisor, a great insurance professional that knows not only how to analyze and determine your risk profile, but has access to the right underwriters and the right markets to get you the right insurances for your company. And you can go on and on. It's having the experts around you to facilitate your success, and you focus on, in essence, what you're great at. So let me push us forward a little bit before we run out of time. So just a couple of more points I'd like to make. One is, let's talk just a little bit about mentors. Just share with us, if you could just think of who you, and there's probably a bunch, but if you could think of one mentor in particular. Remember, the show is Fingerprints on Success, right? So it's about, you know, it's about people having fingerprints literally on the success of others and influencing others in their personal and business success. Tell us one story about a mentor that was really important to you and why they were important to you.
Wow, this is tough, right? Because I think there's mentors, Bill, that you've had in your life that they knew they were your mentor. And then there's mentors who, you know, you just took away something so incredibly profound from them that it changed your view of a lot of things. And I think I told you, jack of all trades, master of none, right? Like, I had an opportunity to do a variety of things for a long time, and it provided me tremendous exposure. But if I went back, and I put it back at, you know, it's a little bit of grit, but your core, I'm probably going to go back to my calculus teacher in high school, which is probably, you're probably expecting me to tell you the time I worked with Bill Rozuk, the former CEO of FedEx, right? And by the way, he was absolutely amazing. I could tell you a great story about Bill, right? Bob Slusky, you know, if you knew him, right? So I went to I went to a high school. So when I originally was in high school, it was an 7th through 12th grade high school. It was Robinson High School, James W. Robinson, Fairfax, Virginia. I think at that time it was the second largest high school in the state, right? We got trailers everywhere, 4,000 plus, phenomenal this, phenomenal that. Halfway through my high school year, so I guess it was my sophomore year, I decided to switch and I went to a Catholic high school called Paul VI, right? And the only thing that made Paul VI famous at that point in time was, I think George Mason University was originally there and decided that the school was no longer fit to actually house anybody in there. And they put Paul VI, right, in off of Route 7. And, you know, the heat didn't work, the building was old, you name it. But it was a really unique school, right? I'd say a third of the students were probably very young in its infancy. A third of the students were there because they were invited to no longer participate in the public education system. A third were probably there because they had a very strong religious affiliation or connection with the school. And a third were there because the school had some amazing teachers and was doing some incredible things. And Bob Slusky, and you can guess probably which third I fell into, but they also had a great swim team, which might have also tied into this. But Bob Slusky was a retired colonel in the Air Force. He was an SR-71 pilot. And if you ever want to, I mean, talk about someone who could captivate an audience of people studying calculus, that should not be possible, right? Like, literally, like, I want to get out of the room as quickly as humanly possible. But Bob taught me a couple of lessons, right? My favorite was, and this one was available for anyone to learn, he had up on his wall in big letters on the left side, I think it said patience. And on the right side, it said think. And I don't know if it was the first day or the second day, someone goes to ask a question. Immediately, I got a question, I'm confused. He went, right? And it never got old. Because basically, his premise was, guys, this is not rocket science. 90% of whatever you're getting ready to ask, you have the ability to figure this out. Relax. And maybe it was his military training. I mean, look, SR-71 pilots were, right? I mean, just amazing, right?
Yeah. Now, those are those crazy planes that looked like they basically had two, like, rocket fuel giant engines on them, and they were like a point, like a dart almost, right? I mean, I can remember seeing pictures of these things.
They were known for speed and height and flying in very hostile environments, right? But the ability to stay calm, right? And what he was trying to teach us is, look, you know, stay calm. Don't rush. Be patient. Process the question. Think about it, right? So that patience in thinking, because, you know, I think one of the jokes he would say is, you know, look, guys, this isn't rocket science, and I've been around rocket scientists, right? Like, And generally, he was correct, right? And I'm making this distinction. Obviously, he was an incredible teacher, but it was just the point where we've all know this, right? You go into an environment, maybe it's at work or maybe it's in a setting. Well, just tell me what to do. No, no. You know what to do. Be patient. Think through this. Formulate your question in a way, right? Learn from it. So that was amazingly impactful. And I will tell you that led to a lot of my experiences in work and the ability to get through just different situations. I never went into engineering. I could have, but that process of patience and think was just awesome, right? The second one was, it's always better to pay the piper early. And my favorite one was, I don't know if it was a swim meet and then a party or you name it, whatever. I was not prepared for my calculus exam. So I did what every smart, crafty, cunning high school student would do is I was sick that day and didn't come to calculus.
Uh-oh.
Didn't go to school. Had a note and everything. It was great. I was a good student, right? Well, I arranged to have the retake with Bob. And it's kind of like that movie, A Beautiful Mind. Or not Beautiful Mind, Sixth Sense with Bruce Willis and I forget the young actor.
M. Night I remember that movie, yeah.
Yeah, M. Night Shyamalan. Like, I didn't know what the smile meant, but I figured it out at the end of the story, right? So he smiles as he hands me the exam. I literally thought I was going to die. It was the hardest. I couldn't even understand half the questions, whatever, right? Like, so I turned it in. And I was like, oh my gosh, that was absolutely horrific. Didn't think of anything. Next day I come in, he comes up, he's like, hands me an exam. He goes, I'm surprised you got one question right. I was expecting zero. And what he later said was like, look, you disrespected my time. I know you dished because you weren't prepared. You now put me through more work. So I'm going to create an exam that there's no way you're ever going to pass. Now, was he trying to be vindictive? No, he was trying to help me learn a bigger lesson, right?
Right.
And what I didn't know is he didn't pull my exam. He pulled a college next level calculus exam that I luckily got one right. Right. So I got a D, but I smiled at him and I was like, lesson learned. I get it. Right. And I think that carries front. So like you mess up, do it. Right. You're not prepared. That's on you. Get prepared next time, right? And I admire the heck out of the guy. The other reason I was, look, he could have done anything. I mean, he was an SR-71 pilot, and he came back to teach kids and inspired some folks. And I look at him, I'm like, man, that guy was remarkable. I have a funny one, which is going to say an entrepreneur story, but that'll be time permitting. But it wasn't related to Bob, and it's someone who would never even know my name to this day. But it was a
I think in selecting one that Bob was certainly worthy of the story and the time. And I think that's great. And by the way, when you said earlier, like you wouldn't think like, the unlikely source of this huge inspiration, it's often that the best stories are about the unlikely sources. When I think about my top mentors, one of them was a Little League coach. I could probably do a whole show on him, but, for another day. So before we wrap up, because I want to respect the time of you and our listeners, I want to talk just briefly about, or have you talk to us about, what has you excited? When you think about, you reached a point in your professional life and personal life where you've reached a high level of success, you've already built successful companies, you've got one now, you're building another. What has you excited when you wake up in the morning? What are you pumped up about that you want to share with the entrepreneurs and business owners that are listening?
Look, I think, it's like everyone says, you reach a certain age and you go back, I wish I had known this. I wish I could have done this differently or had this impact. I think, Bill, I'm reaching the point where, and I've always been to a certain degree this way, like I love talking with customers. I love being on the phone and making a difference and engaging with them. And, my greatest days, and when I say days, I'm not talking Monday through Friday. I'm talking Monday through Sunday. And I know in a lot of schools that's not healthy and this and that. But like if a doctor sends an email on a Saturday, I'm going to respond and I'm available, right? And you can ask why, because that's not work for me, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's not work. I love that, right? And so when I get the most excited, and this is a little bit of a dual-edged sword, is when I do a 15-minute, and literally, I kid you not, half these calls are 15 minutes, the other half are 30 minutes. When I do a 15-minute to 30-minute call, and I show an independent business owner who might be making 10% EBITDA and struggling, how in 5 minutes of their time after this call, I can deliver them on average 40 or 50K. I had one the other week. It was $125,000 a year in increased profit. That's exhilarating, right? Now, it's not even about the money. It's about the amount of work they would have had to do to create that same amount of money.
Yep.
That's transformational, right? And the reason I say that's transformational is, you know, you pick great wealth management firms, you pick anybody, you pick a client who can reinvest in their practice, themselves, their family, their kids' education. That money has real compounding long-term strategic advantage to them. And like my view is, like, you know, people say time is value, money. No, it isn't. Time's time, money's money. What you do with your time is how you create money, right? Like, if I can help them, I know I can change their life. Now, you can say, well, that's fine and dandy. I can tell you this, it's more about that than it's the $99 we're charging them as a customer. First point. Second is, you know, look, I've got three kids. Two of them are still in college. My third just graduated. He's working in a vet clinic. It's been his life passion. All he wants to do is be a veterinary. And I'm passionate and excited about the opportunity of showing him and demonstrating to him that private practice ownership will still be an option and a great one for you when you get done with vet school. And I'm going to make the introductions to the great folks out there, like your Peter, Tanella, and those resources, the account. I couldn't agree with you more, right? And I'm going to help you have the option to consider these great partners who can help you with your long-term success and be successful, right? Now, on the non-dental personal side, you know, I'm looking for ways, and I, you know, supported some friends to help them achieve that or help their children achieve that kind of success. I think, you know, way too often we now, and I look back and I told you why I did it, we fall into the, this is the standard path people need to take. And I just, you know, I don't think so. I think there's wonderful paths for everyone. And, you know, if we can help, I think it makes a difference. And I mean, truly help like you did. I mean, I know in your career, mine, the relationships I have today, I didn't build over the last 5 years. The vast majority were built over decades, and they were built over by serving, not asking, by providing value always with nothing, looking for nothing in return. And to me, that's exciting. I enjoy it. I didn't get my life dream, which was to coach. I wanted to retire early and coach high school sports. Did a lot of little coaching, but that one I'm going to miss.
Well, listen, for a guy who hasn't officially turned 50 yet, as far as I can recall,
I just got there.
Oh, yeah. Happy birthday. Okay. Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, plenty of time left for coaching, by the way. So let's finish with this. I have one last thing. It's a fun fact, and it'll only take you, I'm sure, a second to answer, but I just have to, for those, some people are probably listening, but others are watching because our podcast is both audio and visual. Most people have bookshelves behind them when they're on these calls or we're doing these meetings filled with books. Yours is filled with what appears to be hundreds of bottles, and if I'm looking at it correctly, of bourbon or whiskey of different types. Tell me a little bit about what I'm looking at behind you right now.
Well, the truth is, in this part of you know, life's journey, so my wife and I last October stumbled into a, we were looking for a vacation home and stumbled into an island I'd never heard of. And we ended up buying the home. And we actually ended up moving here full time. No bridges. It's remote. No lights. But it's a wonderful place called Dufusky Island, South Carolina. The home we purchased had this giant bookcase. And it was intimidating because in the life of Zoom and cameras, I had nothing to show, right? It's not like I had the 100 certificates of the employee of the year and all the toys. And I didn't know how to fill it. So I thought I would create something truly distinctive. As far as personal enjoyment. Now, yes, I do love collecting the different bourbons. They're fun for me. I'd call it a hobby for sure. There are some scotches. There are also some some unique bottles that have been sent to me from friends overseas, colleagues who I work with. So it's fun. We even have our own distillery. It's the Fusky Island Distillery. So
Very cool.
Supporting the cause. But yeah, I will say this, for the vast majority, it does open up conversation. The only downside is if a bottle goes missing, then, and you're on the call frequently with people, you might have some explaining to do. But it's fun nonetheless.
Well, when I'm in South Carolina and it's 6 o'clock, I know where I'm going for happy hour. So.
Absolutely. Anybody's welcome. Bill, I sincerely appreciate it. And, you know, look, I failed a lot. I certainly have perspectives. I'm not ashamed of the perspective. And if anybody ever wants to reach out and just talk about their situation, I'd be thrilled to provide my 2 cents and see if I can be helpful through my friends or network. Because I mean it, like, you know, we're only as good. I mean, first of all, we're only as good as the people we associate with, but it really takes all of us to make things work out here on the entrepreneur side. And you know, I want to be one of those people. Someone looks back and 30 years from now says, "Man, that guy wasn't so bad."
Yeah. Well, Alex, thank you for being on. Really appreciate it. Appreciate all your stories, the candor. I think that our listeners.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Fingerprints on Success podcast. Make sure to hit subscribe on your chosen platform that you are listening to us on. If this episode made you think of someone, go ahead, take a screenshot and share this episode with them, or post it on your social media to share with your friends. You can catch the show notes for this episode and any mentioned links in the description of this episode. Mandelbaum Barrett PC specializes in partnering with successful business owners and proven entrepreneurs on all of their legal matters. Visit www.mblawfirm.com for more information. Once again, it's www.mblawfirm.com. We'll see you on the next episode.